Again, most of this material is from the research of Pauline Voss out of the University of Minnesota. The theological thinking and pieces here and there have kind of added to it, but she deserves most of the accolades that would go with it. And this is an important statement, which those of you who hadn't been here, I think it's important to know. Everyone experiences ambiguous loss, if only from breaking up with someone, or having aging parents or kids leaving home. As we learn from people who must cope with the more catastrophic situations, we learn how to tolerate the ambiguity in our more common losses in everyday life. It's important, from the perspective that I bring to this, is that we view it from having a theological component. And I like the concept of time, especially as we see it in the familiar chapter from Ecclesiastes 3. The word time is found 27 different times here. And when it's used in the sense of ambiguous loss, it's viewed more from the perspective of a Hebrew understanding, of an Old Testament understanding of time, which is more like a bowl, more like a crock pot where you add ingredients and it just takes time to simmer. It just takes over a period of time to gather what its outcome is intended to be. Not as opposed to a quantitative measurement like a ruler or a wristwatch. I enjoy my cartoons. Those of you who haven't seen this, if you're speaking of time, if you're 57 years old, the doctor says, "I'd like to have you get it down a little bit. Here, this is what is meant by ambiguous loss, a loss that is unclear, that is not concrete, that can have different meanings, and others often do not see or give it the same meaning that we give it ourselves. There are two types of ambiguous loss. One is where the object of emotional attachment is physically absent, but psychologically or emotionally present. And the second one is just a reverse of that, where the object of emotional attachment is physically present, but psychologically absent. By psychologically, I mean emotionally. Again, just briefly, physically absent, but psychologically present, the catastrophic examples of those would be missing in action, soldiers missing from disasters, which you often find, especially when items in a home are blown away and they have a special emotional attachments to them. Certainly from a personal, relational kidnapping, hostage situations, disappearances, incarcerations. The more common aspect of this are relationship loss or divorce, relocation, empty nest, deployment, separations, changes in worship forms, new political leadership. Any questions? Those of you who are new, if you're following along here. Again, the converse of that were physically present but emotionally absent. The catastrophic examples are dealing with Alzheimer's, dementias, a chronic mental illness, a traumatic head injury, a coma, where obvious the person is physically present but emotionally absent. But then you have the more common ones, which we experience, being those that involve like a substance abuse problem, that one lives to drink, or one lives for their high and is present physically, but emotionally is gone. Similarly, when there is affairs where the emotional life is spent with someone else, depression, where the person is lost in the depths of their in the depths of their depression. Acute grief, and by that I mean where after a significant loss, one is isolating themselves over a period of time and are physically there, but emotionally are not. Different forms of obsessions. The use of the computer, the use of the handphone, or excuse me, of the iPhone. Hobbies can have that where one is so absorbed in their hobby that they do very little to contribute to the emotional life of a relationship. Or other major preoccupations. And hopefully you can see in these examples the movement from the more catastrophic to the more common. And I know I've really appreciated in the last two times we've had great interaction with those who are here sharing their life story. And there's something about ambiguous loss that it touches us all, and we have our stories around it. We also talked about what often happens with ambiguous loss and the various effects of it, from our emotions to our physical side to interpersonal, even its effect on our spiritual life. If you want me to stop. Emotionally, it helps with ambiguous loss to understand what's happening. And it's significant to point out that it's very energy consuming, especially when we hold the emotions inside. For with an ambiguous loss, we can't problem solve, but the problem is somewhere between final and temporary, between is or the person is or is not coming back, and we live in that great in-between. And possibly we don't want to talk, yet we need to talk. And what confuses it often is that ambivalence is mixed with ambiguity. Ambivalence is mixed with ambiguity. I've seen that in my work in the Army Reserve as a chaplain with families where there have been multiple deployment, and the spouse that's left has some ambivalence and can take that ambivalence out in forming another relationship, which only confuses and complicates the issues in their primary relationship. Bottom line is it's an emotional roller coaster. It takes so much energy and then depletes, and then there's that high of possibility, and then only to experience a low of reality. The roles of the previous life prior to the ambiguous loss, the role has changed. I think a good example of that is where in the catastrophic of Alzheimer's, where there may be a mutual relationship of give and take, and then it becomes a caregiving role where there's a disparity of energy that's given to the quality of the relationship. Rituals change, and by that I mean using the holiday season. The loved one who may be there often or before is no longer there, but you don't know if they're coming back. So there's a feeling, a gap, and how do you deal with that? Or you have your loved one who is having dementia, and they're present. So you spend a lot of time making sure they're taken care of, but yet they're not contributing to the emotional life of the gathering. So the rituals are changed. And what hinders and does not help with ambiguous loss is this idea of there being one right way to respond. And this is often affected by various cultural differences and religions in how loss is dealt with. I one of my most difficult situations. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in Florida. Was do you know what blended families are? It's where like second marriages and you blend two families together, and that has its own challenges. And now some of you are living that out and doing very well with that. Was a situation where the woman had a son like age 8, and she was from one of the Central America countries and married an Eastern European man, and she married him in order to get a green card. That became very clear. Probably you're familiar with that story. But what happened, he was kind, and she literally fell in love with him, and he fell in love with her. So it was kind of a bittersweet story, but what began to happen was that her son reached the teenage years, and there was the ambiguity around how do you manage a teenage son. That the wife began to realize she couldn't do it the way she was raised. And so there was a loss attached to it. And what was so important to her is that she wanted her son to have a relationship with this man who was a good, honest man with integrity and treated her well. So working with the different cultures itself is important, that we understand it, that we understand that there are cultural differences. But to view it from the perspective of mastery, this particular man, the culture that he was raised in was, there's one right way to do things and you do it. You go on. Mm-hmm. Certainly much different than her culture, which was more of a evolving sense of dealing with emotions over a period of time. And under mastery is this idea of dealing with it and moving on quickly. The quicker the better. But with ambiguous loss, such a goal is never completely mastered and leads to increased frustration, detachment, dissociation, or even a sense of failure. Because we never, never completely master it. We never, never completely. There's that lingering thought, it's there. And what happens when we have mastery as a goal, it diminishes the importance and the power of trust within relationships. Because if trust is in relationship, we have an awareness that, hey, I haven't mastered this, but I'm trusting my partner, my individual I'm mostly attached to, will have an understanding. And from a faith perspective, that can be questioned, and prayer life can also. Now, this is a loaded question, and I don't know if we want to spend that much time on it, but obviously with our political evolvement that's taken place in the last number of years, we have a lot of feelings attached to it and a lot of divisiveness. But there's some ambiguous loss attached to it. We still have, and we honor and are taught to honor our leaders on the one hand, but on the other hand, we can't. You know, and what do we do with those mixed feelings? What do we do with that? You know, yeah, we wait until the next election, which is the appropriate thing, but in the meantime. And this is my favorite cartoon. I don't know if you can read that. The lady tells the man who she's walking with, if you're bored with yourself, imagine how I feel. Okay, this is sort of, those of you who have been here before, thank you for hanging in there. Reviewing for the new ones. Those of you who are brand new, do you have any questions about what's been said so far?
No.
Okay. And anybody have any comments in review, or you've given this some thought, please mention them at this time.
Sure, yes. It's been discussed before, but you can have both types of ambiguous loss at the same time, both the physically, you know, present, and so on.
But it may be a different situation, but you're dealing with both.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's okay not to like it.
I just want to say something about the leadership, and to mention the leadership in churches when pastors lead.
Yes.
And when pastors leave because of difficult situations like sexual harassment, you know, it's kind of hushed up oftentimes, you know, and just move on, what happened, intermediate pastor, you know. So that is a really difficult situation.
Well, I think pastors have unique challenges, having been there with parish ministry, having 10 years or so of that. I had people that I was, who were significant in the life of the congregation, and then all of a sudden, you don't see them. And you know something's going on, and you want to give them time and space, but you're still emotionally connected with them. And they may have an important role in the life of the congregation, you know, significant role. I'm not even mentioning contributions. I'm mentioning significant role. And then you don't see them. So there's a personal sense of what's happening. And how pastors deal with that becomes significant in how they maintain themselves in ministry, prevent burnout, and hopefully bring it in such a way that it benefits the life of the community that they're in leadership of. I think it's for his attitudes to live with ambiguous loss. It begins with giving ourselves affirmation of holding two ideas or views at the same time that are not aligned. And in the process, to facilitate an ongoing conversation between the views versus an absolute way of embracing the absences or that which is present. Think about that for a minute, maybe in some of your own stories, and you can bring it to life if you don't mind sharing your own story, how you've discovered or how you handle a particular life situation that you had to hold two conflicting views over a period of time. Tell me again your first name. I'm sorry, way in the back. Yeah. I thought your story was wonderful. About your, helping children during their time of using you and your wife, and they're becoming very attached with one particular young lady.
Well, the story was, I was a third foster child, and I was actually away for training for a few weeks, and she went up for adoption, and I had been thinking of adopting her, and it didn't happen. And that was 20 years ago. She still feels like my daughter.
But what impressed me is you shared your story. Am I butting into you? You're still talking.
Go ahead.
What impressed me with your story, if you don't mind me sharing it, was that you even thought about quitting doing adoptions.
Right.
But you had to reorient your thinking about what the purpose was. And I thought that reorientation of thinking was you continue to live in and help in that environment, but you viewed it from another perspective.
I realized that sometimes in my life I need to change my expectations.
And I think that applies there wasn't an absolute way of embracing the problem. The absolute way of embracing it might have been the system needs to allow you to adopt a child. But the system didn't allow you to adopt a child. But you got meaning and purpose with what you were doing. Embrace the possibility to emotionally stretch, to become elastic with our emotions. And that ain't easy, especially if we have gotten affirmation for viewing life in a certain way, for viewing relationships in a certain way. It's sort of like a suspension bridge. It's still attached to two sides, but it can weave and move and yet still be a suspension bridge. Pressures, changes, and ambiguities, growth is the end result. Okay. Dr. Boss emphasized is the importance of resiliency. And what I did here was put it in real small caps to begin with. To begin with, because we all seek resiliency, but at the same time, it doesn't come overnight. It's not an immediate, like, we experience an event and we respond to it and we discover, hey, I did something that I've never done before. And that gives us encouragement to do more. So resiliency is a process. Basically, it's the ability to live with less discomfort and more acceptance of the ambiguous loss. Luther pointed out the importance of praying without ceasing. Obviously, we don't fold our hands and walk around all the time, but that's an attitude of who we are and whose we are. Carl Jung, the psychologist, talked about the words bidden or not bidden, that God is present. And certainly another aspect from a faith perspective is as Lutherans, as Christians, realizing who we are as baptized children of God. That's something that's been done for us and given to us so that we can wake up each morning with that awareness and that realization.
To be able to love without judgment.
Pardon?
To be able to love without judgment.
Tell me some more about that.
Well, I was thinking of what I had to learn to deal with a companion and a sister who both had one drug problems and one alcohol problems, and to learn to not be judgmental about their situation and treat them with as much respect as anyone else, and in that energy of acceptance and appreciation and love, somehow it helped them change. Because they realized they weren't being, chastised or whatever you want to call it. But very hard to do.
And that very hard to do probably couldn't be emphasized enough. accepting what we can't change is part of an ambiguous loss. But yet it's incomplete. So we want to, if there's a little bit that can be changed, I'm going to work at it. If you have family members or with a substance abuse, how that affects families, it can be monumental. How it affects relationships, maybe tomorrow my loved one will come home differently.
I had a therapist who said it was really important when I spoke to my sister and she was in bed, don't stand above her.
Don't what?
Don't stand over her when you speak to her like that. Don't sit beside her, but put yourself in a lower physical position.
Oh.
And it made all the difference in the world. Something so simple.
They do that at the best restaurants, too, if you notice that. The waiters, they're not on their knees, but they certainly bend down so they're at eye level. And what does that communicate?
Well, you're not being critical, like, I'm better than you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Serving.
I think it's important that we all have a place of unambiguity, a place where we go that we can immediately sense an aha, it's okay. And for me, it's my box garden. I will just go out there and whatever's on my mind, for even if an instantaneous moment, it's unambiguous. Doesn't mean it doesn't have weeds, it doesn't mean it doesn't have that sort of thing. But it gives me a sense of, and I connect it to my growing up in the country and what gardens meant. It could certainly could be your church. You know, you're there alone. It could be your flower garden. It could be a place in the community. Even when we're dealing with the ambiguity of life and the losses that are ambiguous, that this is one place. And maybe some folks feel that a little bit like that at Holden. You can kind of let stuff go. And it's important to let stuff go even momentarily. Even momentarily. Now that's a Christmas time too in Central Florida.
Wow.
There's some parallel stories of Scripture that have meaning for us. We think of the children of Israel. Remember, they're in, after the Exodus, they're in the desert region, free of slavery. But what do they do? What do? They start complaining. Because there are things that they missed, even though they loved what they are, but there's things that they missed. And the story of Moses in the desert region is part of the part of, not only did they do it in the desert region, but they did it again when Joshua was their leader as they moved into the promised land, if you remember. They complained, okay, we go here, we don't have security, and listed all of their complaints, and Joshua reminds them. So they like being free, but don't like certain things of having to, that went with it. There's a wonderful concept of how to view desert, how to view wilderness, and in between. Because when we experience within ourselves ambiguous loss, we can often experience being alone, that it's a place that very few people know what's going on. And the actual Hebrew word for wilderness is a place of not knowing what. It's a place that has no words. It's a place that is so uncomfortable that we wonder what is real. And living with ambiguous loss is not unlike the wilderness and the changes it brings and the not knowing what. Let me ask comments, questions. I'm doing all the talking, and my voice is, as I drink my apple cider vinegar. Any comments about what's been said, or your own reflection?
I just remember when I first got called to a church. The congregation wanted to grow the church. You know, they wanted to have more members, and so we got there and we started growing the church. And had more members coming in. It's exactly what they wanted us to do when we got there. And there was so much ambiguous loss because they weren't the small community that they were anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of tension and loss. Even though that's what they wanted, was more people, there was a great sense of loss, too, because it wasn't the same community it had been. It was changing.
Yeah.
It was hard to name that as grief because it was what they were asking for.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
And how how wonderful it could have been in a non-threatening environment to have both sides identify what their fears were, mm-hmm. or what their hopes were.
We actually did have a therapist come in and meet with the long-time members and let them...
Oh, was that helpful?
Yeah, but they met with separately from the pastors who were called to be there so that they could talk with him and talk about their sense of loss and their grief, you know, their grieving and what was going on, and have a safe place to do that that was away from us doing what we were called to do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Thank you. Thank you for those comments. Therapeutic goals of ambiguous loss. There is no way to go through all of these, and it can get kind of too much information. But the therapeutic goals around ambiguous loss, and we've touched on these in the conversation, involve these six areas: finding meaning, being able to temper a sense of I need to master my emotions, giving permission to reconstruct who I am, normalizing ambivalence, revising attachment, discovering hope, we'll just go through the first one. Finding meaning within the ambiguous loss. Being able to make sense of an event or situation. Again, you don't have to like it. It becomes accepting the reality of it. And then that making sense, naming the problem, naming the issue, naming the forces at play. And in turn, what occurs is holding two opposing forces simultaneously, where each is named, each has a voice, and is heard. Possibly you've seen one of the television networks occasionally with what's taking place in our divided political scene in our country, where they take individuals who are so strongly identified with each perspective, and they agree to be respectful, they agree to let other people have their voice, and to be heard. And there's something that happens when that occurs, even though you may disagree strongly in that reality, that a person feels a sense of respect and dignity because an opposing side allows them to say it, and vice versa. Part of the ambiguities, and this is just Mel talking right now, is that we don't allow those who are in different places of position, and we have that in our own family, possibly you do too, to know that they're being heard and know that they're still being valued, even though they're at different places. Holding two opposing forces simultaneously, where each is named, each has a voice, and is heard. The positive attributions begin to filter up, mitigating the negative ones, the negative forces at play. And certainly what's so important in all of this, from the perspective of faith and spirituality, is that enabling us to live in more of a sense of comfort and acceptance, while yet inside of us we're still churning. We still haven't come to making total sense about it. Any comments, questions with this?
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, until I realized that retirement and relocation was going to have, I didn't realize it was going to have the effect on me until we took a course and they said, look, these are some of the major things that can cause the feelings of ambiguous loss. Mm-hmm. I didn't, because everybody went, you know, when they contact you, say, well, congratulations, it must be wonderful. And I'm going, it doesn't feel wonderful. So it was helpful for others to validate that there's a reason to feel not so happy about it.
It's normalizing.
Yeah.
Normalizing. Yeah.
One example that keeps coming to my mind is when people move into assisted living or retirement facilities, and I don't know if it's the way they're structured or whatever, but quite often even their best friends don't come and visit. You know, it's like, it's almost like it might be contagious or something.
Yeah.
And it just seems like they sort of get shut off from, you know, I live in Wenatchee, in a small town. Mm-hmm. And my parents moved into a retirement facility, first retirement apartment and then assisted living. And you know, I was really kind of shocked. The people that didn't, you know, I'd see in town, they say, oh yeah, how are your parents doing? Well, they're, you know, they're in Cherry Street, you want to go see them? And it's like, you know, we kind of, I don't know, I mean, there's clearly an ambiguous loss there. Mm-hmm. On both sides.
Sure.
But it just, it's almost like it's structured that way. And you hear that somebody's, you know, kind of going downhill, and then you're sort of afraid to visit them. And then, you know, they're having mental problems or whatever, you know, memory issues or whatever. And it's like, you know, how do you sort of break through that and have your own experience with them rather than sort of taking that all for granted that they're quote unquote taken care of?
And that isolation is probably contributing to the mental degradation.
Yeah, I don't think it helps at all. No. For sure.
Yeah.
In Florida, we have a retirement site called the Villages. Have any of you ever heard of that? Now it has over 100,000. You have to be 55 and older. My agency did some work with them. The largest Lutheran congregation in Florida is in that village. Mm-hmm. They worship over 1,000 each Sunday. And they have a Sunday school of one. It's the son of the pastor, of the assistant pastor. The Villages, a couple of things are interesting. You know, dealing with reality in an age-appropriate way. The Villages also has the highest rate of STDs in Florida.
What?
You know what? STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. It's sort of like moving there to live the good life. And they have like 5 different locations. They have activities every, and they have like 65 different golf courses.
Wow.
And not, you can throw different kinds of interpretations on what's happening there. But the fact of not being able, you know, it's like regaining my youth. The fountain of youth. But also another event is happening is that after a period of time, a number of years, a couple of decades, as folks are declining in more significant ways, that more and more people are leaving there to go back to die. Mm-hmm. Where they came from. Tremendous challenges from caregiving perspectives. You know, as people do stupid things and things that are self-destructive. A lot of alcoholism there, a lot of party scene, and trying to, you know, the fraternity scene, and you're 60 and 70 years old. Makes you wonder. To be able to talk, and part of the challenge is, from a caregiving, from a pastoral perspective, is helping people to talk about what they like about it, what they don't like about it, what is the loss that they no longer have. And some of the sexual acting out, some of the drinking and the party scene has to do with trying to regain something, or prove something. Mm-hmm. And of course, what they prove is they have to look at the mirror eventually. I don't know why I got started talking about that.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
So the people that leave to go back to their homes to die, but also to be taken care of, has there been any research on the ambivalence or whatever, you know, of family members who, you know, they left, but then here they are, now they want them to care for them at the end, kind of thing?
It's community. It's a predictable community. When they go back, and certainly loved ones are there and wanting to spend that time with loved ones. But what they find, too, is they haven't spent a whole lot of energy on maintaining those relationships. So they go back in the sense of here we are, and folks are asking, who are you? I mean, why are you here now? We haven't seen you in all these years. So it becomes a different kind of ambiguity. It becomes a different kind of ambiguous loss. And even though they may be in their 80s, the emotions around ambiguous loss are still very real. Yeah?
I'd like to say that that doesn't have to happen just in that kind of a situation. We left the church because we were living in another community 10 miles away. And then when we came back to that community, because we were able to, the 100 relationships that we had previously that we didn't keep up with were gone. Those people knew who we were. We could talk to them on the street, but they had no need to continue any kind of relationship with us. And I think that happens regardless of what's the reason that you have the separation.
Thank you. Anybody else? This idea of suffering to be eradicated is more of a Western influence. So, you know, the Eastern influence would be more of how do we live with it? How do we live with it? More, you know, six guns, shoot it, go on to the next villain. Independency and self-sufficiency are the highest of values. But what really helps is a sense of being connected and being connected and feeling connected. And that can take place in different forms.
Mel?
Yes.
I'm over here.
Yeah, Carol.
Sometimes I think, you know, we struggle, those of us who've had ideal childhoods, ideal families, all these wonderful things, and we almost become caught up in nostalgia or reminiscence, almost to the point where we can't prepare for our futures because we remember how our grandparents were cared for, how the reverence that a great uncle had or whatever, and then, you know, we're kind of at a loss because our world is moving so fast, our family members don't have jobs in the same communities anymore, and yet we're left with this sense of, oh, I remember those the way they were before. And so we almost aren't prepared to change, and especially as we get older, change is harder. But anyway, so it's again, you know, I ask myself that question, is it going to be the same? Is it going to be different? Is it up to me to craft a different future?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
I work as an occupational therapy assistant in a skilled nursing facility. So I'm working with people who have had a change in their life, either hospitalized, like from a stroke or something, and trying to recover, or they're just recovering from a fall, or multiple things. And one day I was working with a lady who had multiple issues going on, And during our conversation, during our therapy, she said to me one day, I need to learn how to be okay.
I need to learn how to be okay?
I need to learn how to be okay.
Did you say okay?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
That really struck me. Because she realized the change in her life. And she was probably not going to get back to a prior level of functioning. So she had to learn to be okay with where she was, with all the changes, and move on from there.
Well, that's an excellent example of someone getting to the place where they're holding two views emotionally at the same time.
Yeah, letting go of the way she used to be and embracing the way her life was going to be.
Right, right.
With the changes that happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, and helping her...
I had to write that down, and I keep it on my clipboard at work to remind me. As I work with other patients in case they find themselves in something similar.
And as a caregiver, to experience those moments with the person that you're caring for and giving that person affirmation can be a significant time for the two of you. Because you see it, and then you're affirming it, and that creates a bond. That creates a bond that comes out of your life together. Mm-hmm. Other comments? Yes.
I'd like to share, 6 years ago, the first time my husband and I came here, and there was a member of the teaching faculty, while I can't remember her name, her son had written Three Cups of Tea, which maybe you are familiar with.
Yeah.
And she herself had been a pretty outstanding person and was a superintendent of a large, like Detroit, a big city, and she gave a class in which, she was approaching 80, so she called the class, her view of the next 10 years, she called 80 before 80, so maybe she was 71, and in that time period from 70 to 80, there are also other times in your life that are significant to doing this. A lot of people from 20 to 30 or 50 to 60, but anyway, older people I can really see for. And she encouraged us to do what she was doing with other people, where you imbue the things that you can no longer do, that you keep stretching yourself to see the things you can do and are still possibility. And I followed a woman around at Holden that week thinking, I'd like to do that. That's something I'd really like to do. For every, when I turn 71 or 75, I'll keep doing these 10 things, looking for 10 things every year that still excite me, that still give me hope, knowing that I can no longer do this as well as that as well. And this woman at Holden, who I had seen, she had Alzheimer's, and her family was helping her a lot, but obviously for years her family had, she'd come with her family there. So she was able to manipulate her life with the help of, I hope none of her relatives are here right now, but it should be encouraging, even if they were, that they were helping her still have a life at Holden. And she got up in front of the people. They used to have an opportunity in the morning. I think they still do in some form where you could go up to the microphone. I've seen it here in the last couple of days. And I looked around for her family and think, oh my gosh, she's walking up to the microphone. Where's her family to help her now? Mm-hmm. She got up to the microphone, and for 5 minutes, she talked without any notes, any help. And it was really life-changing for me to see her do that. And afterwards, I said to her, gosh, you did a great job. I really enjoy what you're saying. Well, she said, why don't you do this? Why don't you, still have more time here. Why don't you do this? Get up. And I thought, oh, well, I thought it was nice that you did. No, she said, I'll show you where the sign-up is. And, sure enough, she walked up and she said, see, nobody's signed up for tomorrow. Why don't you put your name there? Well, I did. And you know, all night I worked. But that was the first of my 10 things for that first year when I turned 70.
Oh.
And it's really effective.
Well, she modeled something.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. And you observed it and you were ready for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes we live in the ambiguity and we feel helpless. You know, we even feel like this is who I am. It's when we're able to make that spark, that or receive that spark, that says, that's not who I am. Yeah, and to define ourselves not by the ambiguity, but to define ourselves by a different way of responding to it rather than being, a harsh word is being victimized by it, but giving it more power is a way to look at it. Giving it more power, then it's to our benefit. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Yeah, I think these, you know, the environment, how many of you continue to live in the home that you lived in for 30 years? Okay. Are you thinking about the day that you will no longer be there and what's involved?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, and as we age and as we age, the identifying ambiguous losses and being able to articulate what they are, it's to our benefit and it's to the benefit of the people who are most important to us. Because they see it too, and if they see us being able to articulate it, I don't want to talk about it because it's going to stir up something in Mom. But if Mom's already talking about it, it becomes a conversation that can be beneficial for all. And as you were talking, I'll share a personal story. My father, who died 15 years ago, was a blue-collar worker. And he worked with cattle a lot, as well as working in a general store. And the folks around our, and he was there for over, they were there for over 40 years. And he became more frail as he was, he could carry quarters of beef on his shoulders in his late 60s. But then his knees gave out. And then he lost that sense of, who am I? So when we would visit, when I would visit him, obviously he was somewhat depressed. And the ambiguity of the importance of it and of not being able to do what I used to do was there, a great sense of loss. But my goodness, he wanted all of his children to be educated. He didn't have the vocabulary I had. You know, he saw things from a sense of, if there's a nail that needs to be pulled, I'll pull it. So I took him to an auction sale. How many of you have been to a cattle auction sale? Yeah. In Lamb Passes, Texas. And yeah, where he used to go, he used to take me as a kid. And, you know, they bring the cattle through and they go through the auction. And, you know, it's a cultural event. It's a cultural event. People have on boots and they buy their cattle. They do it differently now than what they used to do. And the auctioneer, when we came in and I sat by my dad and I had to help him because he was becoming frail, the auctioneer stopped the auction. And he said, I see one of us there, and that's Ben Jacob. He knows as much about cattle as anybody. And, you know, it transformed him. It's sort of like, I don't know what a common, I mean, that was his culture. That was his environment. And those kind of folks don't give those kind of that-a-boys. You know, you're identified by what you do. But what that did for his sense of loss and well-being, and what it did for me, is when I would come home, I told my mother about it, I told everybody about it, because I thought it was so significant. He was able at least for a period of time, to have a renewed sense of purpose. And, I talk about it today, and I still have a sense of emotion that wells inside of me, because I was so glad I was there, and I was so glad that he was able to get a sense of self-acceptance. Mm-hmm. Yes?
In psychology, we would call that a peak experience.
Say it again?
A peak experience.
A peak experience?
Yes.
Yeah. Amen to that. How we deal with time?
Oh.
Yeah, Carol.
I just listened to an AARP web thing on getting rid of objects in your home. I don't know if any of you have listened to that, but there was two people advising, and they really did have some good advice because, you know, we've all know what it's like to have your family want to hand you things that they see as valuable, and they're talking about with this generation, you know, there's really no interest in antiques anymore, and even thinking that you might be able to sell your belongings, you'd be shocked at what you're probably going to get from them. But they made a big point about the thing to do is maybe try to work with family members in different generations to share the stories related to that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even like in your example of, you know, how did that make you feel to be able to get that side of beef over your shoulder and divide that up and give it to the households? Mm-hmm. You know, to get people to share the stories can do a lot, I think, to help mitigate or, like you said, re-envision something that was meaningful. It's not so much maybe the object but the story that went with it.
Well, I agree with you. I've been impressed as I've walked around how people use the back porches here and are just talking and sharing. That's, you know, I project all kinds of good things about that. there's a lot of positive things. And an environment like this can facilitate that. And how do we find that when we leave here? When we leave here. Any other closing, comments briefly? Again, I want to thank you for your participation. Thank you for listening to my somewhat compromised voice. And again, if you want to learn more about the details of this, her name is Pauline Boss. And she's is now deceased, but you can find that on Amazon. And